This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
I'm no black widow. Pam Smart snares a high school lover to murder her husband, and now she's going to walk free. This after 22 disciplinary problems behind bars, many of a sexual nature. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
Pamela Smart marries her boyfriend, Greg, expecting a fairy tale future, but it quickly spirals into tragedy.
Pam Smart, a media consultant at a local high school, snares a teen lover, and between him and his buddies, manages to murder her husband. But now she's set to walk free. Okay, what I don't understand is why he is still in the coffin, yet she wants to walk free.
The stereo had been removed from the stereo rack and it was pulled out. There was speakers piled up by the rear door where it looked like they had exited. There was jewelry boxes overturned.
Derry police find the Smart's condo ransacked and Greg Smart lying in the front entryway with a towel wrapped around his head and a single gunshot wound to the back of his skull. While the condo is messy, a few valuable items are missing, and other things appear to have been left behind in a hurry. Greg Smart still has his wallet in his pocket and his wedding band on his ring finger. Officers question if Greg's murder was a botched robbery or an execution.
That didn't really make a lot of sense because the time of day, a nighttime burglary in a neighborhood like that, there were a lot of residents there.
That last sound from our friends over at Oxygen. You may not remember the name Pamela Smart, but I'm sure you remember the name Nicole Kidman and one of her many, many fantastic performances in To Die For. I'll never forget it because I had investigated the Pam Smart case myself, and then watching the movie really brought it to life as if it needed resurrecting. Joining me, an all-star panel to make sense of what we know right now, but straight out to Colleen Cronin joining us, investigative reporter, Boston Herald. Colleen, thank you for being with us. Where is Pam Smart as we speak?
So Pam Smart is actually in a jail in New York, even though she was convicted in New Hampshire. So that makes this case a little bit complicated because it's sort of playing out in two districts.
Colleen Cronin, it's not complicated to me. She, a newlywed, started a sex affair with a student, just turned 15 years old. Okay? There he is on the right. Lovely picture. That said, she starts a sex affair with a teen boy, convinces him her husband is abusing her and the only way she can get free is to murder the husband. She says, hold on, Colleen. Randy Kessler joining me, high-profile trial lawyer out of the Atlanta jurisdiction, Emory Law School professor, former chair ABA Family Law Section, author of Divorce, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. Kessler, let me see Kessler, please. Kessler, she, and this is according to sworn testimony, convinced the teen boy that she would lose everything if they got a divorce. They're like 25 years old. They're sharing a condo. Lose what? The pot and the pan?
Right. And that just would convince anybody to go out and commit murder. I mean, Nancy, you share things when you're in a relationship. The relationship was bad. It was not an appropriate relationship. But to say my relationship with my husband is bad and then take the leap to, that means I want you to go put a bullet in the back of his head. I mean, who's more responsible here? You know, her, maybe she did some bad stuff. It was bad, but he put the bullet in the guy's head, and he's walking free. He's out. She's not.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. Wait a minute. Colleen Cronin, didn't he do hard jail time for this?
He was in jail. He had been sentenced to 28 years. He got out when a couple years ago. He had originally been released on work release, and now he's out of prison, and Pamela Smart is the only one of the five people who were convicted in this case who is still in jail.
So is that right, Sydney Sumner? Sydney is joining us, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Did he get a 25-year sentence? Is that what the teen lover got?
Yeah, that's about how much time was spent behind bars. All of these young men were released by the 25th anniversary of Smart's murder. Two of them earlier, the boy that sat in the car and did not participate, and the other boy that waited with him, who was the getaway driver. Those two were released earlier. The two that were inside the apartment spent more time behind bars, but Pamela Smart is the only one still in prison for that murder plot.
Okay, I'm not quite sure why you're putting the emphasis on that, Sydney Sumner, like somehow it's a bad thing that she's still in jail. Let me ask you a yes, no, Sydney Sumner. Is her husband, you know, the dead guy, the guy that was shot in the head, is he still in a coffin?
He is, Nancy.
Oh, okay. Well, then why shouldn't she still be in jail? And I don't like the way Kessler just tossed it off like the other co-conspirators got a light sentence. They did not get a light sentence. They got 25 years behind bars, and many of them did the hard time. It was her idea. That was clear. Although, for years and years and years, she said they all lied, and she was the only one telling the truth.
Pamela Mohos grows up in Derry, New Hampshire, with dreams of becoming a broadcaster. Pamela enrolls at Florida State University, majoring in media performance. Pamela hosts her own radio show, calling herself the Maiden of Metal. Home for the holidays, Pamela meets fellow metalhead Greg Smart at a Christmas party. In 2 years, the couple is married, Greg moving to Florida for Pamela's senior year. After graduation, Pamela, 22, takes a job in New Hampshire as media director at Winneconnet High School.
Okay, back to Colleen Cronin. What is a, quote, media director?
So she did a couple of different things. It seems like she was writing a lot of press releases for the school district that she worked in New Hampshire, sort of like a PR specialist in a way. She ended up getting an intern who ended up testifying against her in her accomplice to first-degree murder trial.
Okay, why am I seeing photos of her in apparently a strapless bra and underwear? What was that for? Here's my theory, Sydney, that I've told you many, many times. If you don't want it on page 6, don't put it in writing, and for Pete's sake, don't take a picture of it. It will land on page 6 of the New York Post or the front of the Daily Mail. There were two sets of racy photos from Pam Smart that we know of. This was not the set that she sued over. There was another set of racy photos taken by a jail guard. And I can only imagine what they were. She sued over those and won about $23,000. Her lawyer got most of it. So Miss Thing has been responsible for quite a series of so-called racy photos. That does not make her a killer.
Well, she sued several tabloid lines from behind bars in her 23-hour-a-day isolation. She charged these tabloids with releasing these photos without her permission. And these were in magazines in the supermarket, Nancy.
Okay, well, didn't I just tell you if you don't want it on page 6 of the New York Post, don't put it in writing, and for Pete's sake, don't take a picture of it? Didn't you hear me just say that? Sydney, that's a yes, no.
Absolutely. Yeah, no grounds
to stand
on
there,
Nancy.
Okay, well, she did, and there it ends up. Everybody looking at it when they're checking out their skim milk. Okay, that said, back to the murder. This is where it all starts.
While the newlyweds seem happy as can be, decorating their Derry condo and adopting Shih Tzu Halen together, there's trouble in paradise just 7 months after their wedding. Pamela begins spending more time at school, volunteering for a drug awareness program. Pamela takes on a student intern, Cecilia Pierce, who introduces the beautiful 22-year-old blonde teacher to sophomore William Billy Flynn. Pamela Smart entertains and encourages all of Flynn's flirting, and it's not long before she's having a full-blown sexual affair with a 15-year-old student.
Okay, there you go. So, you know, back to you, Randy Kessler, veteran trial lawyer in the Atlanta jurisdiction and beyond. So when you pick co-defendants to carry out a murder, it's probably best that you don't pick a high school girl. Agree or disagree?
High school girl? You shouldn't pick anybody to co-defend, but I agree.
Okay, Kessler, I think that sadly you're missing my point. Of course, don't commit a murder. Doesn't that go without saying? Don't kill anybody. But if you are going to kill somebody and you have to include co-defendants, I think a Gabby high school girl is probably not the best choice. Now that I've explained it to you and served it up to you on a silver platter, do you think you can answer now? No offense, but I mean, really.
Well, the offense is taken when you say when you plan a murder and you, because I wouldn't plan a murder and I wouldn't think like that. But yes, you know, nothing about this was smart. None about this was well conceived. But the truth of the matter is she didn't kill him. It would have been worse had she done the killing and pulled out the gun. She at least had a chance to get away with it by having somebody else do it that had a different motive, which was to continue a relationship with her. So it wasn't the stupidest plan in the world. It was not smart like her name, but it was, there's no way to say what's the smartest way to plan a murder like this, in my opinion. But I get what you're saying. It's smarter to get a boy than a girl to do it. I don't know.
No, I'm saying that anytime you involve a high school student or a defendant that has a lack of maturity, you can count on them blabbing at the drop of a hat. And they all did, not just the girl. They all did. So let's be clear about what the law actually is. You, Randy Kessler, continue to keep stating she didn't pull the trigger. Well, that's simply not the law. If she masterminded the murder and convinced someone else to commit the murder and planned the murder, then she is just as responsible, if not more so, than the minions that carried it out. That's the law. Do you disagree with my rendition of the law?
No, I didn't, and I don't. I think you're right on the law. But you were talking about, is it smart? If you're going to commit a murder, it's smarter not to pull the trigger.
Okay. You keep saying she didn't pull the trigger. She didn't pull the trigger. Are you contesting the fact that she planned the whole thing? Are you saying she didn't plan it? She had nothing to do with it.
Look, you know, the jury decided, so you go with what the jury decided, and this is hindsight. But did she have a good defense? Yes. Was it harder to convict her than someone who pulled the trigger? Yes. Was there a plausible defense and plausible argument she could make? Yes. Her marriage was bad. She talked about her bad marriage with her boyfriend and her paramour and this young student. But, you know, the jury had to make the leap that she actually went overboard and convinced him to kill her husband. At least that was a better defense than if she would caught with the possession of the gun that actually murdered her husband. So, you know, the law, yes.
You're right, Kessler. You're right. She had to convince the jury that the shooter and his friends, the shooter was actually her teen lover, and his friends did this on their own, that she never instigated them to do it. She may have complained about her marriage. Yes, she may have involved a teen boy in a sex tryst. Yes, that's bad enough. But her argument would have been that he decided to murder Greg Smart all on his own. You're absolutely right. What choice did she have? Okay, let me ask you this to Colleen Cronin, joining us, investigative reporter, Boston Herald. Colleen, how did she convince? What did she offer the co-defendants in exchange for murder? What did they get out of the deal?
Billy Flynn wanted to continue seeing her, and so the, you know, murder kind of was predicated on their relationship being able to continue after.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Sydney Sumner, I seem to recall, in addition to what Colleen told us, that there was the promise of $500 and some stereo equipment, something like that.
Right. So continuing the relationship was enough to lure Flynn into doing this, but those three other boys weren't just going to break into somebody's apartment and kill someone to make their friend happy. So these other three boys were lured into this murder on the promise of all of the valuables from the Smart condo and $500 worth of insurance money that Pamela Smart was set to receive when her husband died.
There you see Greg Smart, and we are blurring much of it out of respect for his family, they don't need to see this all of this again. We're blurring the worst photos. Right there in the foyer of his condo. I don't get it. Back to Randy Kessler joining us, and then to board-certified forensic psychologist Allison Paganelli joining us. But Randy, this isn't the first time we've seen this happen. There's something about domestic law, as they call it, family law, divorce, custody. I've had veteran criminal defense attorneys tell me they would rather defend a drug lord or a killer as opposed to getting involved in a domestic dispute, such as a divorce, because the lawyers are afraid they'll get shot. Why not just get the divorce, go your separate ways, and start your life over? Why resort to murder? We've asked it a million times.
I ask it all the time of myself, and we talk about it in our office with our staff. You know, and all we can come down to is the person that you're mad at is there, right? It's human rejection. The person you committed your life to, you went all in, you promised God and your family, this was the person for you, and they're telling you they don't want you, you're not good enough, they reject you, and people just snap. You know, it's not like a murder or a car accident where it's planned and there's a one day. This is a build up, and the judge imposes a solution and says, you're not going to see your kids for 2 weeks, you're not going to have the money you thought you had, and people don't know how to react, and they snap. That's the best we can come up with. Human beings are human beings, and they lose control. And it's what scares all of us as family lawyers, that you never know when that breaking point's going to happen. But yes, a simple, and amicable divorce, a well-thought-out divorce, is the solution if you're not happy. This is not the solution.
You know, how old was she, Colleen Cronin, when she had her, you're seeing crime scene footage right there, just as the jury did. How old was she when she ordered the hit on her husband?
Well, she was 22 when she was convicted, which was in 1991, and the murder happened in 1990. So she was relatively young, older than the boys who committed the crime, but relatively young when it happened.
So she's 22, and they're, what, 15? Is that correct, Colleen?
16. Billy Flynn was 16 when he committed mm-hmm. the crime.
Mm-hmm. So she was relatively young, but murderers have been put away at age 22 for as long as I've been practicing law, and a lot, and many, many years before that. Now, tonight, as we go to air, Pam Smart is seeking release from behind bars. And I wonder if the appellate court and the parole board is looking into the case in the depth that we are, because I haven't forgotten Greg Smart, and I haven't forgotten the pain his family endured. Straight out to Allison Paganelli joining us, board-certified forensic pathologist, over 18 years experience, and you can find her at the website parkdeetsassociates.com. Allison, thank you for being with us tonight. We keep dwelling on the youth of the defendants and the youth of her, Pam Smart, played on the big screen by Nicole Kidman. But that youth is a double-edged sword, because Smart's family devastated. He was young too, devastated when their son, their baby boy, their brother, was cut down in his youth as well, with his whole life before him, by Pam Smart, who was getting it on with a 15-year-old boy at school. What about their suffering, Allison?
Well, I think the suffering they've had to go through over and over, as each of the co-conspirators have appealed and gotten out early and those type of things, has been horrible. But I think particularly involving Pam Smart, their son, brother's wife, is that she has not really taken 100% responsibility, or at least matched up her story with what the evidence has shown. I believe it's just been in 2024 where she said, I'm responsible. But when I talk about, you know, taking responsibility, you know, thinking about how devastating things have been for her husband's family, but also these teenagers that she got involved in this plot, how it impacts their relationships going forward. For a 15-year-old to be having sex with someone in their 20s, yeah, they're all young, but 15 and 21 are there. It's 6 years, but it's a big 6 years of difference. And so for her to not acknowledge, you know, what they went through carrying this out, which is horrible, but they were also really young, but really she's just more focused on me. Why can't I get out? Everyone else got out. I didn't even pull the trigger. Every time she comes up with another court battle, the Smart family is, you know, re-traumatized again, and probably just wanting her to acknowledge her part in the whole thing, which is the main part.
Alice Paganelli, I appreciate pointing out how young the other defendants were at the time they murdered Greg Smart. They are out living their lives now. He is still in a coffin. His family still visits his grave. That's a big difference, don't you think?
It's a huge difference. It is.
Flynn runs his plans past Cecilia and Smart. After school, Flynn, Patrick Randall, Vance, J.R. Latimy, and Raymond Fowler will take Latimy's car to Smart's condo. Fowler and Latimy will wait in the car while Flynn and Randall go inside, take what they want until Greg arrives home, then kill him and make off with the stolen items. The gun is only meant as a backup plan, but when Greg tries to flee, Randall can't hold Greg still enough to stab him with his knife, and it's Flynn who pulls the trigger of Latimy's father's gun, killing Greg Smart.
Pamela and Greg meet over Christmas break. 3 years later, they say, I do. But just 7 months into their marriage, their once happy relationship unravels.
Tonight, Pam Smart is going before an appellate court, demanding release. True, her co-defendants have been released, but she was the mastermind. She was the mastermind. And back out to Colleen Cronin joining us, investigative reporter, Boston Herald. You mentioned at the get-go that she, Pam Smart, is now in New York. Why was she moved from her original CI Correctional Institute?
Well, when prisoners have issues at certain jails, sometimes they're moved somewhere else. Sometimes that's more often because there might be some gang issues, but when you also have disciplinary issues, that can be a cause for moving to a different jail.
Disciplinary issues like Sydney Sumner, what disciplinary issues did Pam Smart have?
Well, one of the largest, she was beaten to nearly a pulp because she inserted herself in between two other inmates' relationship, and they believe she had snitched to the warden about what was going on and gotten them separated. So she was beaten to a pulp.
Actually, she had a drug possession charge, punished for possessing tramadol, also contraband. She had a cake knife in her cell. Sex misconduct. She had sex contact with a fellow inmate at the New Hampshire State Prison for Women. Unsafe behavior accusations. 22 disciplinary reports in all. Okay, one of the reasons she was transferred to New York out of her original CI. What was the big unraveling? Again, it all goes back to having co-defendants that are teens. I want to go to Dr. Kendall Crowns joining us, renowned chief medical examiner, Tarrant County, that's Fort Worth. He is the star of a hit podcast, Mayhem in the Morgue, which is awesome. He is an esteemed lecturer at the Burnett School of Medicine at TCU. Dr. Crowns, thank you for being with us tonight. Could you describe the wound, the mortal wound sustained by Greg Smart?
So he had a single contact range gunshot wound to the side of his head. Contact range wounds usually mean it's about 6 inches off the skin. The muzzle flash burns the actual skin, causing a sear mark. And then you get soot from the gases being released by the bullet firing. that embed into the skin as well. So you have this soot and sear showing that it's a contact range wound. The wound then passed through his skin, his skull, and his brain. The bullet itself was a hollow nose bullet, so that means it mushroomed to cause maximal tissue damage as it went through the brain.
When you say hollow nose, I refer to it as a hollow point. Could you explain why those are so evil? What happens with a hollow point?
So with the hollow point, when the tissue hits the nose of the bullet, it causes the nose to expand because it has this divot or the hollow portion of the nose of the bullet, which has little kind of cut marks in it. So it expands into little petals. And these petals expand out and fold back and make the size of the bullet bigger. So it tears through more tissue and causes a lot more damage. And it also makes the bullet stop quicker so it doesn't exit the head, so you don't hit other targets.
Dr. Kendall Crowns, that sounds terrible. And throughout my history in law enforcement and prosecuting, a hollow point was considered the worst. Do you agree or disagree, and why?
So hollow points are quite bad because of the expansion causing maximal tissue damage. The one thing is high-powered rifle bullets, I feel, are the worst because they have so much kinetic energy, they basically turn everything into mush. But hollow points are up there in the category of really bad bullets because of that expansion and the tearing. And another thing is, for the forensic pathologist, is those little petals can have sharp edges on them. So when we're retrieving them from the body, they can actually cut our gloves or puncture our skin. So they're bullets we don't like seeing.
And the hollow point, Dr. Kendall Crowns, tore through Greg Smart, age 24's, head. Do we know the path it took, the trajectory path?
I don't know the exact path, but based on where they said the bullet was, it would have probably gone through the parietal lobe of the brain, which has what we call the motor strip in it. And the motor strip is what controls your body functions, your movements, everything like that. So it would have instantly incapacitated him, and then it would have continued through other brain structures, possibly the brainstem, killing him instantly.
According to what I read in the autopsy report, it entered just above the left ear. How does that jive with your analysis?
That would be about right. Left ear would be right around here. That is the parietal lobe of the brain, and that controls motor functions, things of that nature, and speech. As it passes through the parietal lobe, you have a possibility of passing through the brainstem because it would sit around that left ear level. And then once it goes through that, it would basically be lights out, killing him instantly.
When you're saying, what are you saying? What type of lobe are you saying?
Parietal lobe. So your brain has multiple different lobes, frontal, parietal, temporal, and occipital. And each one of them has different functions, of course. And the parietal lobe does a lot of sensory control, motor control, things of that nature.
And again, Dr. Kendall Crowns, you stated that there was soot around the entry wound. There was no exit wound for the reasons you explained. Are you referring to stippling?
No, so stippling is a little different than soot. Stippling is when you get a little past that 6 inches and you're between 6 inches and 2 to 3 feet. Stippling is the actual gunpowder grains hitting the skin, abrading the skin, or embedding into the skin, causing gunpowder tattooing. Whereas soot, when you're in a closer range, is actually all that gunpowder, instead of being widespread, causing the stippling, are all together forming this massive black kind of sooty area around the wound. So it's more of the smoke caused from the gunshot combined with all the unburned gunpowder hitting the wound, causing the soot and stippling. But this is more just an impaction of all the soot on the wound, along with burning from the muzzle flash.
Terry emergency.
Yes,
emergency in 4E, Summerhill Condominium. There's someone passed out. I don't know. A girl is hysterical in here. She just ran over. Her husband is passed out.
As tension grows at home, Pamela meets a 15-year-old boy and fixates on him, getting into a new secret relationship.
He told you the story about what? About how, what
he happened? Told me how they did it.
How they did what?
Killed Drake's mom. So they went there and they broke into the place. And they set it up to make it look like a burglary. And I guess the guy tried to run or something and they grabbed him. They threw his dog in the cellar. Pete said he held the guy's head while Bill shot him.
That from our friends at ABC 2020, and that is Ralph Welch. So, Sydney Sumner, who is this guy, Ralph Welch?
So, Welch is not one of the four that participated in this murder plot. He learned of it secondhand from one of the teens that did participate and was concerned. He went to J.R. Latany's father and told the man that his .38 pistol may be the murder weapon. And Latany turned that gun over to police. He noticed that it had been recently cleaned and questioned why that would have happened. He didn't recently use the gun. So once Latany went to police with that gun and told them who told him that the gun may have been the murder weapon, Ralph Welch was pulled straight into an interrogation room.
Let's take a look at Welch again. That's what he gets for cleaning the gun.
He told you the story about what? About how, what
happened?
He told
me how they did it.
How they did what?
Killed Drake's mom. So they went there and they broke into the place. And they set it up to make it look like a burglary. And I guess the guy tried to run or something and they grabbed him. They threw his dog in the cellar. Pete said he held the guy's head while Bill shot him.
Yeah. $500, is that what Pam was paying them? Or?
That's what they said she was going to pay him.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about Pam. Who's Pam?
The guy's wife.
Okay, Pam Smart.
Okay. From our friends at ABC 2020, Sydney Sumner, the five convicted in Greg Smart's murder. Some of them claim that Greg Smart was killed by accident, that he struggled, that it was never the plan to shoot him, and that he ended up getting shot in the head, which I find very unusual because the whole point was not to steal the stereo equipment. The whole point was to kill Greg Smart so Pam Smart could be free.
Right. I don't think either of the teens in that apartment truly believed that Greg Smart being shot was an accident. I do think they intended to use a knife to kill him because a gunshot in a condominium apartment, that would obviously draw a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And the gunshot was not heard by other people because police didn't arrive for hours until Pamela Smart arrived home and called 911. But yes, they intended to kill him in a more quiet way.
But, you know, Dr. Kendall Crowns, it struck me at the get-go, if he had soot around the wound, that means it was a close range, very close range shooting. And I don't know how. Right behind the left ear, close range, practically a contact wound, could be an accident.
I know that to me, that doesn't sound like an accident unless there was some sort of struggle or something with the gun. But the back of the head or the back of the side of the head really seems more like an execution than anything else. It doesn't sound like a struggle at all to me.
Randy Kessler has tried a lot of cases, not just heated divorce cases, but violent felonies. It's really hard when you have physical evidence that belies your claim. For instance, in this case, the five, are claiming it was an accident. We didn't mean to kill him. But you've got soot on the entry wound right behind the left ear, which sounds like an execution-style killing. It's not like you're struggling and boom, the gun goes off. It wouldn't have happened that way. So as a defense attorney, what do you do when you realize there's forensic evidence that could torpedo your whole defense?
It's a tough one. You start pointing the finger. I mean, Nancy Grace coined the phrase SOD. Some other dude did it. Maybe I wasn't the trigger person. It's just hard because you have tons of motive and a story behind this whole explanation. Why would these young kids shoot an older man? You know, and there's an explanation. So it's really, really, really hard as a defense counsel to do anything other than to say it was the heat of the moment. Things went awry. It was a burglary. Something went bad. The guy reacted in a different way. It was confusion. These are young kids. They didn't know what
they
were doing.
You know, Randy Kelser,
you throw everything you can.
Truly the kiss of death. And this happened in the Jody Arias case. So you got your client. Your client's lying, all right? You're trying to help your client. The client's saying it was an accident. It was an accident. It wasn't execution style right behind the ear. We were struggling. And then once your client is up on the stand, the state gets him on cross. And that would be the perfect moment to make the defendant come down in front of the jury and act out the scenario, which is wonderful for the prosecution because you get to put the gun in your client's hand and act it out and then question them. That's the last thing you want is for your client, unless you're O.J. Simpson, to get up and do a demonstration in front of the jury. That is fraught with problems for the defense.
Right, especially if you're the prosecutor. You just have a field day. All you need to do is really get him on one credibility issue, something that they don't believe him on, that he didn't have a relationship or that it wasn't about. As soon as you catch the defendant lying, then like the law says, Nancy, and you know this law, that if you catch them lying on one thing, you can assume they're lying on everything else. You impeach their credibility on one fact, then it can be considered impeached on everything else. It's a very, very dangerous thing to put your client up as a witness.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Pamela and teenager Billy Flynn meet at a volunteer event and secretly begin a relationship. Then one day, Pamela comes home and finds her husband dead.
How often did you talk to Pam about Billy? She started yelling at me. She's saying, well, if you're never going to do this, I want to know right now.
Pete, you got a knife out. All you want to do is, you know, cut his throat.
That was the plan?
Yeah.
I went over the plan of how to kill Greg. I would have rather stabbed Greg than shoot him because the gun was too loud.
She was attracted, and all the guys in school were attracted to her. She was intelligent. Excited to be around. And out of everyone, she liked me.
That is from our friends at Nightline, Investigation Discovery, and WMUR-TV. So I would say that was some of the most damning evidence against Pam Smart Sidney. That was Billy Flynn, the teen lover, correct?
Yes. It didn't take much for Billy Flynn to admit to what had happened and spill the entire truth to investigators. But they knew that Pam Smart was involved in this and was the starting point of all of this.
So not only, as Sidney Sumner tells us, did all the teens crack, like, ouch, it didn't take much, and testify against Smart, but there is another player in the scenario, possibly the single most important player, named Cecilia Pierce.
Pretty much, they've established that, yeah, you've had great kills.
Why, though? Like, you know,
because they can't think of any other reason why Bill and them would do it.
Yeah, but even if I ask somebody to kill somebody, you have to be deranged to say, okay, I will.
If you tell the truth, you are probably going to be arrested. And if you're not arrested, you're going to have to go and you're going to have to send Bill, you're going to have to send me, you're going to have to send JR, you're going to have to send me to the slammer for the rest of our entire life.
Wow, that is dynamite in the courtroom. That's from Nightline and Investigation Discovery. So explain to me, to you, Colleen Cronin, who is Cecilia Pierce?
Cecilia Pierce was Pamela Smart's intern.
And the two of them became close during the time that they were working together. And Cecilia agreed to be taped, to tape conversations between her and Pam after the murder. And that was some of what we just heard.
To Allison Paganelli joining us, esteemed forensic psychologist, Allison, it was argued to the jury by the defense that the boys, the teen killers, had something to lose. They had their freedom to lose, so they could blame it all on Pam Smart and maybe walk free. But Cecilia Pierce was the confidant, the teen girl confidant of Pam Smart. Police got Cecilia Pierce to wear a wire and catch Smart admitting that she was part of it. And unless the teen girl played along with it, they'd all go to, quote, the slammer. And there was no dog in the fight for Cecilia Pierce. She wasn't charged. She wasn't part of the gang going down, down, down. So she had no reason to rat out Pamela Smart. I think that was Smart's nail in the coffin.
I would agree. And I don't think that Pam Smart thought for any minute that her teenage mentee or intern would turn on her. It seems as if Pam Smart felt like she had good control over these teenagers, and that even when, you know, people were being questioned and being caught, she still felt like she could confide in her teenage intern, which was a big mistake because, like you said, it was pretty much the nail in the coffin for Pam.
I found myself responsible for something I desperately didn't want to be responsible for, my husband's murder. I had to acknowledge for the first time in my own, you know, mind and my own heart how responsible I was, because I had deflected blame all the time. You know, now that I am older and able to look back on things, I can see so many errors that I made, and I can see how skewed my judgment was and how immature I was looking backwards. You know, I'm such a different person than I was. I'm more thoughtful before, you know, I think things through before I make decisions, and less impulsive.
To Crime Stories investigative reporter, how long did it take Pam Smart to say, okay, you know, I did it? Because all these years she said, I didn't do it. They did it on their own. And what are the legal grounds she is using for this habeas corpus?
It took Pamela Smart 34 years to admit any kind of culpability for her husband's murder. But despite that, she's now filed this habeas corpus petition. This is not the first time she's filed one of these. This time, she claims that modern science shows that if you're listening to something and you're told what it says, you have a bias to believe what you are told over what you heard. So she's claiming that these wire recordings that were such bombshells at her 1991 trial, prosecutors prepared transcripts of those wire recordings and wrote what they wanted them to say, not what she claimed she actually said in the moment. So she believes that jury was biased against her based on those jury transcripts, and she deserves a new trial.
Transcripts of recordings are handed to juries all the time, every day in courts across our country. That is not going to be a ground for a reversal. But by the time this is finally heard, there's already been one delay, she may have another grounds for reversal. We wait as justice unfolds, as we remember Greg Smart and his family still suffering, imagining all the things they've missed through the years. Anniversaries with him, children, grandchildren, a life cut short. All they've got is his grave to visit. We remember an American hero, Officer Thomas Adams, California Highway Patrol, just 24, killed in the line of duty, leaving behind grieving parents. American hero, Officer Thomas Adams. Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend. This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.